This Week in Radio Tech, episode 266, is brought to you by the Axia IP Audio Intercom. Imagine a digital intercom system with no central matrix, with AOIP simplicity and flexibility. Actually, don't bother. We've built one, Axia IP Intercom, by the Telos HX1 and HX2 telephone hybrids, the most advanced hybrids ever developed for use with analog phone lines, and by Lavo and the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. Crystal Clear is the console with a multi-touch touchscreen interface. Recording techniques and tools are still evolving, and some truly exciting immersive sound tech is emerging right now. Recording engineer Alex Kozorek joins Chris Tobin and Kirk Harnack with lessons in modern recording technique, why 96 kHz sampling is important, and what jobs are demanding skilled audio engineers. Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host. So glad that you're here, and I'm glad to be here too. Chris Tobin is along, and we're going to cut to him in a minute. We've got a great guest, a gentleman who I wanted to have on for months now, and finally we've found time to get together on a Thursday afternoon. Our show, This Week in Radio Tech, is a show where we talk about everything audio and some RF too, from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and to the end of the stream. Maybe I should patent or trademark that slogan. We're going to talk today about audio recording, high-quality audio recording, and Alex Kozorek is our guest, and he is going to tell us a lot of interesting things about capturing that great sound that they capture on location in symphony halls and, you know, various different venues, and how broadcast engineers can help maintain that quality of sound throughout. All right, let's jump right into saying hi to our co-host, and that is Chris Tobin from somewhere in Manhattan, New York. Hey, Chris, welcome in. Glad you're here.
Hello, Kirk. Hello, Alex. Yes, as I was saying earlier, I was doing some work here in a building, broadcast work, and realized the time had got away from me, so I grabbed my Go Kit and thought I'd make a go of it here on the rooftop. I'm coming to you via cellular. So this is a cellular connection, 4G, LTE, the two different technologies, or the marketing names, that is, and it's on a distributed antenna system in the building. So I'm actually only, technically, my modem is about 30 feet from the cell site antenna. So I've got a good signal.
Is that why it's working so well?
Exactly. I've got a nice RF link right into the network. Can't beat it.
Cool. Cool. Well, are you outdoors or close to outdoors?
I am outdoors. Behind me, you only see one of them. The other side where you see the open vertical and horizontal structures is the actual catwalk behind me. I'm on a rooftop with antenna structures, water tank. This is the water tank right here, made of wood. It's supplying water to the building. There are several of them up here. I'm only behind one. And I'm outside. There is a helicopter flying overhead right now. My location is not far from Times Square, New York City, so to give you an idea of what that's about. And I'll tell you later what's on side of the building. But I don't know if the camera shows it. Let's see. If you look straight ahead, there's a vertical structure just between just to the side of the water tower. I'm not sure if you can make it out, but that's the Empire State Building.
Really?
Yes, this camera's aspect ratio unfortunately doesn't give you anything. I can't zoom in manually, but that's... Let me see if my finger can get this spot just...
Oh, yeah, right. I see it. I see it. Sure,
right
sure,
there,
okay.
That right there is the Empire State Building.
Yeah,
it gives you an idea of where I'm at.
Well...
what I can see.
Yeah. Wow. What are the other... are there some buildings that are kind of... that are... Also out there next to it?
Yeah, there's a couple other buildings. There's a bank building across the way with a very large spire on it. And then off to the other side of me is several other skyscrapers. And later in the show, what I'll do is near the end, I'll take the camera and we'll point it up. And you'll get to see something really cool. Because it'll be just about the right time for the sun setting and the lighting should just be right. And,
good.
But I'm definitely outdoors. So you will hear a lot of strange things and... I'm hoping that the chiller plant above me doesn't decide to come online. So
I barely heard the helicopter when you said it was there. So your mic's doing a great job.
Excellent. It's a nice.
I mean, great job of focusing on you.
Yes. Well, like I said, this is my Go Kit. This is what I've been using for 5 years now. For those of you who are inquiring in the recent emails,
we should do an episode on your Go Kit. In fact, next Thursday, Chris, do you have any plans to be just in your regular office, or will you be out and about?
Next Thursday, I think I should be, hopefully at a regular place. Yeah.
We've got some catching up to do next Thursday. In fact, we may play an interview. Have we played the interview I did with Brian Jones yet? I don't think we have.
I don't think so, no.
The one where he's talking about the Ubiquiti nanobeams and making an office out of his RV?
No, No, we have not.
Okay. That's a 20 minute interview. We'll play that. Well, and you sent me while I was in Australia, you sent a couple of great show ideas. We'll do that. And then we ought to take a look at your Go kit.
Okay. Yeah, fine.
All right.
It's a nice little kit. As you can see, it's done very well for me.
Yes, it has. Only a few cops have asked you what you're doing.
Well, I didn't tell the building folks what I'm doing either, so I'm expecting.
Yeah, well, there you go. All right. Hey, let's
jump. Security camera just above my head.
Let's jump right over to our guest, and that is Alex Kozorek. I have not known Alex well for so long, and I'm getting ready to know him better here in this next hour together. Alex, welcome in. Glad you're here.
Same here. I'm glad to be here.
Alex, you let's see. Well, you've made a move in the past year or two, but I always knew you from being in the Ohio area. What did you do in Ohio, and what are you doing now?
Well, I used to be the director of the recording services department at the Cleveland Institute of Music, where we produced a lot of different audio programs and recordings, not only for the Institute itself, but for broadcast. And prior to that, I was in charge of what was called the Corbett Studio, which is a full-fledged audio production facility as part of what's now called Cincinnati Public Radio, where I dealt with all of the audio production for the Cincinnati Opera, the Cincinnati Symphony, and all that. Now, I'm here in charge of what is called Central Sound at Arizona PBS. It's the audio division of Arizona PBS, one of the larger PBS stations that we produce lots of content, both locally and for national distribution. And we take care of all the things classical here for broadcast on KBAQ, all the local productions, and do audio for video as well for the productions on PBS.
Wow. And all those positions really put you in a great position to tell us from hands-on experience, not just theory, but also hands-on about the whole recording process and keeping audio quality just fabulous. And that's what I'm looking forward to hearing about. You're going to be ready, and we had a commercial due, but after that, you're going to be ready to tell us about that?
I certainly am.
All right. Good, good, good. All right. And by the way, I noticed you found a different microphone, and that one is sounding quite good.
Thanks.
All right.
You're quite.
Hey, our show is brought to you in part by, let's see, is it Axie? Is that who I said it would be? I think it was. Let me look at my notes here. Axia and the IP networked intercom system from Axia. You know, the intercom system from Axia doesn't get a lot of talk, at least on this show, in terms of advertising. And that's a shame, because the intercom system is really fabulous. And here's what I mean about that. You know, Axia, LiveWire, and now LiveWire Plus, that's an audio over IP networked system. And the engineers at Axia were able to add an intercom capability to all that. Yeah, just a panel in front of you with intercom stations listed, and you just push and you talk. Or you can lock it on and talk. Or you can listen. Or you can carry on a two-way hands-free conversation. Let me tell you about a couple things about the IP intercom from Axia. First of all, I got to see one in action just earlier this week at a radio station, a pair of radio stations in Adelaide, Australia. I was at Southern Cross Austereo in Adelaide, and they have two big stations there, Triple M, which is a rock station, and as the jocks there say, it's for the blokes, mate. And then the hit station, the kind of a top 40 CHR called Hit 107. And those stations, their morning shows, or as they call them, their breakfast shows, both have producers. And the producers sit outside of the control room at a big long desk where they can see two control rooms and the news booth. And they have right in front of them an Axia IP intercom. And this intercom lets the producer have instant communications with the announcers on the air, in the on-air studio, whether they're on mic right now with their headphones on, or whether they're just walking around or doing some things in the booth, in the control room without having their headphones on. Whatever when the producer pushes that button, the producer is interrupting one side of the headphone feed or talking over the cue speaker in the control room. And the quality is just amazing. Now, you don't need super quality from an intercom system, right? But you've got it. It's no extra trouble when Axia designed it, just to make it another source on the network with a few special signaling protocols to handle the interrupts and headphone split and that kind of thing to call other intercom stations. So the Axia IP audio intercom is just fabulous in that you can use it as a full audio spectrum source. 20 hertz to 20 kilohertz, absolutely ruler flat audio. Depending on, you know, what microphone you're using with it, of course, you can get a cheap microphone or use something high quality. You can also use a mic input or line level input on the back of most of the intercom panels, as well as a line level audio output if you need to feed some headphones or some other quality input. So it's not just a little mic and a little speaker, although you've got that if you want. You can also have high quality audio input and output. That means you can put one of these intercoms into a newsroom, at news edit workstations. You put it anywhere where you need not only voice communication, but where you might need high quality audio for contribution from a news editor or a reporter, something like that. You can handle this audio in lots of different ways. You can run it over a codec if you want to. Stations have done that. You can, you know, of course, have it as part of the local LiveWire Plus audio network in a facility. And the intercoms, the latest software they're working on right now, also talks SIP. So you can actually ring to a voiceover IP SIP telephone or other SIP device with this. And that means that it's got compatibility with AES-67. So that's exciting too. Lots of possibilities. If you are a facility, if you have a facility that is looking for intercom capability, whether or not you've got actually a live wire already, man, this is just so simple to wire up. It's just part of a network, an audio over IP network. Go to the website at telosalliance.com. Look for Axia. And look for those Axia IP intercom panels. All kinds of panels fit in consoles, fit in the rack. And there's even a soft panel that runs on a PC. That's really cool, too. Thanks to Axia for sponsoring this portion of This Week in Radio Tech. All right, it's Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin along here at episode 266. We're talking with Alex Kozorek, and let's jump right into this. Chris, you feel free to jump at any time with questions, but Alex, we had a number of different topics we were going to hit. Do you want to hit surround sound production first? That's a big bite to take off. You want to chat about that?
Well, certainly. Let me start off with how much I really love immersive surround, and it seems to be a topic that's being reinvigorated with ATSC 3.0, the discussions for even more beyond 5.1 with broadcast for the next phase of television coming up in the next couple of years. It's been dealt with in many different respects in radio broadcasting as well, with either matrix surround or a companion surround stream to your live radio broadcast. So it's actually, a lot of people say, it may not be live and well. It is more than live and well. We have lots of listeners who actually comment that when we broadcast in surround, that they really enjoy the experience. So that's something which we've been involved in for a while here at Arizona PBS. And I thought I would discuss a little bit about how we actually capture surround. Most of the work we do...
Hey, help me out here, Alex. You mentioned immersive surround, and I actually haven't heard the demo yet. I was in the NAB booth at Telos during this whole NAB, and our linear acoustic division had this, what I heard was a fantastic immersive surround demonstration, and I didn't have time to jump in there and listen to it. Is there a difference between regular surround 5.1 or 7.1 and immersive surround?
Yes. Probably put as simply as possible, 5.1, you have discrete channel information sent to each of those five speakers in the subwoofer. With immersive, we have tools now that we can say, let's place a sound in a three-dimensional space. And not only do we mean on a singular level far as a plane, but also with height as well. And that allows us to say, okay, where do we want this sound to exist in the space? If you're going to movie theaters now and you find a movie theater says Dolby Atmos or Oral 3D, those are two of the technologies that are out there. DTS has theirs, and there's more and more of those coming out. And some of them are even cross-compatible with each other. But allows us to say, hey, let's place a sound up there in the upper right corner in front of us. And if you have a setup at home that's 5.1, or maybe it's this weird 13-speaker setup or whatever, the devices that are coming in the future will figure out where your speakers are. And then because we said we want this to appear in the upper right-hand corner, then the sound will figure out in through this amazing technology to actually place the sound there.
Huh, that sounds fantastic, and I mean in a fantastical way.
It sounds very mysterious even. It sounds like, how can they do that? It's just quite amazing.
So the elements are now considered objects within the space?
Mm-hmm. It's an object which you move basically virtually throughout the space, and then depending on how the playback system is set up, it'll figure out how to put it in that space that is set up for you in the home.
Does this mean that that a DSP device engine or whatever, that when the producers are mixing this, that they recognize sonic elements and not just a mic that it came from, predominantly, but no matter where it came from, or if it came from more than one mic, that sonic element gets somehow defined and then can be placed in space on a playback system? Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm, indeed. And one of the other amazing things which I'm just fascinated about, and I think it's actually going to help the consumer, is I've seen some different technologies that actually you put this little test microphone in a space, and if you have your speakers set up, I'm sure many of you have gone to people's houses and they have all five speakers in the front of the room. You're going, well, how does that work? These test systems now can say, hey, well, your speakers are messed up and they're not in the true surround position like they should be. Doesn't matter. The system will figure it out and still get the sound to be placed correctly around you. It's just quite amazing.
Wow. Wow. I'm trying to visualize how this works. And, the guys in our linear acoustic division who are also, demonstrating how this works and what tools they have, they were telling me that it's really cool and I need to hear it. And I'm really honked that I didn't go get the demo. All right. So now that we've established that this is different than the regular 5.1 or 7.1 surround we've been used to before, let's please jump in and teach us about how this is captured and then what's done with it afterwards.
Well, right now what we're doing is we're still concentrating on sort of the discrete surround platforms. And so therefore, we still work in that 5.1 or 7.1 model, but we're still making sure that we have all the elements, basically this different microphone feeds, saved. Storage space has gotten so inexpensive. And therefore, that allows us to store all the information and actually get it ready and packaged for that immersive surround if and when it comes available to the average Joe Schmo's consumer. So we have all that. But right now, what we do is we concentrate on different recording techniques that capture the immersive experience, 5.1 being the minimal. But we're also now experimenting with 5.1 plus an extra four channels for height. And it really makes when you listen to the difference of regular surround and surround plus height, it's really quite mesmerizing. It's very realistic onto another world sometimes. You go, oh my goodness, I actually feel like I'm really in the room.
Height. Does height include depth below or only height above?
Well, the main way that we've been looking at it now is most people in their homes have their standard setup of speakers. We consider it like the base layer. And so when we're looking at it from the perspective of surround plus height, is we have that base layer basically where you're sitting at, and then height, which being the airspace or what's above you. Some of the new movie theater technologies that are being used, you have that base layer that's there, you have height, and then you have the ceiling. Or as I heard from one of the people presenting on this at the NAB, the voice of God location.
I was thinking actually the Imperial battleships as they go overhead. That's what I want to hear. I want to hear that rumbling overhead.
Well, probably in Star Wars coming out later this year, that might be the experience. Like, oh my goodness, the ship really is going to land on my head.
Yeah. All right. So not to preview too much the pictures you're going to show us, but I did see a quickie of a picture that had a microphone array overhead. Was that part of what you're capturing to eventually get to immersive sound?
So what I'm going to do is I'm going to switch over here. I have a myriad of photos and I'm going to jump around them, but we're just going to go and look at the photos for now of some of the different ways that we capture the event. Now, keeping in mind, most of the stuff that we record is classical, sometimes jazz as well, content. So a lot of the techniques that we're using are specific to that genre. If we were to switch to a different genre, which is more popular music, we would be using different microphone techniques. So let me go ahead and switch over to that. Let's see here.
I can imagine while you're doing that, let me, in so many movies and television shows and soundtracks, there are orchestral pieces moving us along. And so often, Joe consumer, I barely notice that there is a score behind a lot of the movie action. But there is so often. And wouldn't it be interesting if you're listening to a playback of a symphony orchestra, I'm not sure that you expect to have things above you. But in a movie, when you can do anything, you may want to represent, some piccolo, floating above you that represents something. And I guess I'm not sure we know yet what we want to do with this technology for placement, if it's standard, orchestral accompaniment. I'm sure there are sound effects that movie producers are going to love to place in spaces above our heads. Certainly I can think of action and thriller movies where this will be a big thing, go ahead if you're ready to toss a picture our way.
Certainly. So this first picture is when we were recording one of the best organs here in the area. Let me make sure that we're switched over to that picture.
So far not. I'm seeing you.
Okay, well, let me see if we can get this to share the right screen.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, he has more than one screen.
Da-da-da.
All right. It's thinking about it. There we go.
Okay, well, the picture here that you see is we have a couple different microphones in front of a fantastic organ that's located here in Phoenix, Arizona. And we were capturing an artist named Isabel Demers. And you'll see there that you have the sort of like the bass microphone array, which I call like the stack of microphones there in the center. It looks almost like a cross.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
At the top of the cross, we're using a different set of microphones. In this picture, it's a little hard to see, but that's actually pointing at the upper part of the instrument. So you can actually differentiate the lower level of the instrument, the lower pipes, and the upper pipes in that surround mechanism or that surround immersive sound field. But the other thing which we try to concentrate on our microphone techniques as we do this is also to make sure that it always folds down very pleasantly down to stereo and even mono. So we're always thinking about that. So it becomes a little bit more comprehensive. In the past, it would always be, okay, we're just dealing with a mono source, then stereo, making sure stereo folds down to mono. Now we're dealing with not only 5.1, but also 5.1 plus height to make sure that it all folds down appropriately. So it's always backwards compatible. But you'll see there that there's an array of microphones. That's one of the arrays that we basically created ourselves based upon a couple of different studies that we've done. And the microphone that's at the top is one that we've been trying out for a while. It's called the Sennheiser Esfera. It's this cool-looking stereo XY microphone that actually the elements are very, very highly calibrated. So it goes through a decoder and actually gives you another 5.1 layer of audio to work with. It's quite stunning.
Now, Alex, correct my thinking here if it needs correction, but I noticed that on the apparatus that looks like a cross, that's got your baseline of microphones plus the microphone or an array, whatever, at the top of it. I was always thinking that the reason you do co-located microphones is to avoid phase issues if you collapse that to mono. What kind of phase issues do you have to worry about if you're recording 5.1 and you know it's going to need to collapse to stereo and perhaps to mono as well? What do you have to be careful about?
Well, the things that we have to be concerned about is the timing of the sound coming from the sound source to the microphones themselves. So we're working in a height perspective. So if we were to look down on the microphones themselves, the microphones are pretty much lined up with each other. So the arrival of the sound from the instrument to the microphones is pretty much all the same. So that's one of the things that we have to be concerned about to make sure that when it folds down, it doesn't have those phase issues. But also, and especially with classical, phase is sometimes our friend. It gives us a sense of envelopment and a little bit more about the space around us. We do know that, of course, when we're taking stuff that does have some things that are a little bit out of phase, that when you fold them down, of course, you're going to get some comb filtering and some other things that cancel each other out. But we try to make sure that one of the elements that we take care of is that time element, time of arrival to the microphones. And so now, not only with that array are we concerned about that, but also when we add in spot microphones, let's say that we were adding a microphone very close up to the instrument, we would actually delay that microphone and make sure that it matches so the time of arrival of sound from the sound source is the same.
Okay. What kind of tool do you use to match that phase?
Mostly we're working inside the DAW, and we do some old-fashioned clap techniques. What we'll do is we'll go out there with a clapper, and we'll go by the instrument itself, and we'll hit whack. Even a pair of drumsticks works just fine. And then we'll measure that on almost any DAW you can do this. You can go in and you can zoom in on the waveform. You see the spike. you measure the spike between one microphone and the other, and you go, oh, that's 6 milliseconds apart. And then you can add the appropriate delay.
Ah, okay. Well, that makes sense. And so that's if you want to spot a, like maybe a guitar or a piccolo, I don't know. So you're going to spot something with a one microphone and then add that into the mix. That's the correction that you make to mix it in.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Wow. All right. Learn something new. In that picture you've been showing us, there's a couple other vertical stands there. What are those?
Those are for, we've also added, I'll go back to that picture in here in just a second. Here, I'll go back to that. So that also gives us a little more of tools that take back to the production studio to see what else we can do as far as growing that space that you are going to be experiencing. In some cases, we'll actually make more than one mix, but we have this system and our techniques basically automated. So we can say, okay, for core stereo, we're using our core microphone stand where all the timbre arrivals happening at the same time. But if we're creating something that's just having those extra channels and we know that it's going to go out to a discrete channel playback system, then we can add in those extra microphones to give that more immersive experience.
Cool. All right. Well, okay. Yeah. Next picture to show right there, I believe.
Yeah. So just thought, all right. I'm going to scroll down to a whole different type of microphone array that we use, and it's also using one of the, I'll jump to this.
Oh, so my goodness.
This is something which we discovered just about 2 years ago. It's a recording technique called STAG. Now, for the life of me, I can't remember what STAG stands for. It's like stereo augmented something or other. It's got some weird words.
Yeah.
But it's something which, if you're an AES member, you can go onto their website and dig through and find out what this technique is. But it's basically a set of two sets of ORTF sets of microphones, one pointing backwards, one pointing forwards. The one pointing forwards is usually cardioids. The rear pair is usually hypercardioids. The diaphragms are right on top of each other, so that creates the same kind of concepts of near coincidence. And you can actually, depending on where you set it, you can actually steer the sound forward or backward. So you'll see in this location, it's up high, which is usually in classical recording, we're getting a little bit of height above the instruments to get some distance from where they're playing. And now we can actually, in post or even live at the event, we can mix in how much room that we want into those microphones. And it folds down absolutely beautifully to stereo and to mono because all those microphones are coincident. And I'll go back to the former picture that we were at.
By the way, you mentioned the phrase ORTF, and I've heard of that. And I just looking up here, it's a way of recording a stereo image. That can, do you have some possibility to manipulate that image in post recording? Is that what it's for?
Well, regular ORTF is a stereo recording technique has been around for a long, long time, and that is basically a coincident pair of microphones spaced a little bit. It's usually cardioid, splayed at about 120 degrees. About the diaphragms are about 7 inches or 8 inches apart from one another.
Right.
And that's something which, when you fold down something to stereo, it works incredibly well. Okay. Now what we're doing is we're using a forward facing of an ORTF pair, essentially, and a rear facing pair of ORTF, essentially. And that allows us to still keep all the microphones in a coincident scenario. But now you can mix in the forward-facing microphones, essentially the group, and the rear, which could be the hall or the audience. So now you can actually, with a small array, this looks big because the picture is blown up, but it's actually a pretty small array once you get it up in the air.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Here's another cross-section of it. Now, this one looks a little bit more crazy because we actually have another microphone sitting on top of it, and that's that Sennheiser and Sfera mic that we've been trying out for a while. Because we're also using that Sennheiser Sfera on a couple different situations because that microphone system is actually developed for ENG video cameras. Because most video cameras going out there for work only have a stereo input. So you put those two microphones into a standard camera and you record the atmosphere and then you bring it back to the studio and then you can run it through the decoder and get yourself discrete, not some quasi stuff, but discrete surround out of those two microphones.
Now that very top microphone, does that have more than one diaphragm? Is it, or is it just one?
Yep.
Okay.
Let me see if I can go right back to the former picture here, just to see if we can go back to the blow up. So you can, if the it's facing forward would be facing to the right. So on this picture, so you'll see there's actually it looks like an XY microphone pattern, and that's essentially what it is. But what they've done is, you know, what they've told me is they've highly calibrated these microphones to be very matched in frequency response and everything else, so they can actually derive the surround content out of it. And I know that people in Canadian broadcasting company, they've been using quite a few of these, especially for television, because of that, hey, I can only record with a stereo input on my video camera and derive surround sound content for sports and other types of broadcasting.
Wow. Okay. Wow. This is so far out the usual broadcast realm of engineering and beyond what we talk about here. But it's great to to get a picture, to get an idea of the issues that you deal with in recording out in the field. What's that? Okay. There we go. What's next to show? Chris, are you got any questions at this point?
No. Yet. No. This is cool stuff. I just love
Yes, I'm soaking it in here.
I have some questions, but so far you've answered every one each time, so I'm good.
Go ahead, Alex. What's next?
Oh, so the other challenges that we have, both in registry flat-headed recording or in live broadcasting, is that we're always out in the field. We're in a different place almost every weekend or sometimes every day. So we have everything in the road cases. This is a typical picture of one of our, believe it or not, less complicated setups. We're recording everything to a computer, and we have high-end mic pre's that you see there on the left. We're making CDs for the artists. We have backup high-definition recorders on the right-hand side there. A variety of equipment to get our job done. And that's just for the capture of the sound. We haven't even touched on how we sometimes need to get this to go all the way to the broadcast plant and all that kind of stuff. And you'll see there in the lower right-hand corner, we have an Antelope Orion running at 96 kilohertz. And some people might ask, why are you recording at 96 kilohertz instead of at 44.1 or 48, the typical broadcast standards? And we have a couple food for thought to answer that. And one of them is we don't know what's coming up 5-3 years even in the future. We don't know what else is out there, so we want to make sure that we're going a little bit higher quality sampling rate. We're not doing it because we can think that we can hear at 25 kilohertz. I know I can't. Can you?
No.
But we also do it so when we're in post-production or doing any manipulation of the sound on location, we actually have the frequency. I like to call it frequency headroom, which is really not technically correct term, but the frequency bandwidth to manipulate compression, to manipulate equalization without running into other issues that may occur, such as a very sharp Nyquist frequency filter or something else, because a lot of people don't realize that even though things get recorded at 44.1, 48, the processors, like I know that the linear acoustics processors, the Omnias, they actually oversample. They double, triple, quadruple the sample rate to make their calculations. So that what we're doing is we're actually starting off with a higher end product to make those calculations, those manipulations more possible in the workflow that we're in. Hopefully that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe a good analogy would be if you're a professional photographer and you're doing photography for a magazine, you're almost always going to be capturing and working in a higher resolution than what the end user ends up seeing in a magazine or on the web. Or any other format that the consumer is likely to take in your photographic expertise, but we're working in a higher res format so that we don't bump into resolution problems that then actually do show up at the consumer end. So not only, as you mentioned, it's recording at 96, we don't know what consumer format's coming down the pike. Maybe it's going to be so simple, cheap, and easy to let you play back 96 kilohertz audio at the consumer end. Maybe that'll be a standard one day at the consumer end. But for now, let's capture it as best we economically can so that we can manipulate it, do math on it. And hey, with DSP, we know there's a ton of math going on. And you're right. Audio processors often work at very high sample rates inside, far higher than what came in or what's going to go back out.
Indeed. And the other thing which I like to mention to a lot of people is that even iTunes, when a lot of submissions go into iTunes, they request for a 96 kilohertz master. Mm. So you have to think to yourself, if they're asking for that now, something's going to come down the pike. I wouldn't think Apple would be asking for that just because.
Yeah, yeah.
So here's the last photo, which I thought I would share. And this is just one of our, we make many orchestral recordings. And this one is our setup for the Phoenix Symphony here in Symphony Hall here in Phoenix, Arizona. And for these particular situations, we have the fun and joy of having to fly all of our microphones. And we actually take that seriously because we do acknowledge that our microphone stands can become a bit of an eyesore, especially when people are paying $45, $55 or more dollars per ticket to see that performance. Yeah. So we're flying microphones. What you'll see here in the center is a pretty common recording technique. It's called the Decca Tree. And if you're not familiar with it, I highly encourage you just to type in Decca Tree into Google, and you'll find out this is an array which is usually 2 meters across with a bar sticking out the front about 1 meter forward with a microphone on each one of those edges of that tree. And those microphones are usually omnis with a little bit of high frequency boost that gives you a little bit of directionality in the high frequencies. The microphones that we're using in this particular case are Sennheiser MKH-800s, but there are other microphones that serve the purpose quite well. There's ones that Neumann makes that are called M50s, which are like four times the size of these. We don't use them because they're four times the eyesore.
Oh, yeah, okay.
As well as we get a little skittish when we're putting a lot of weight above a conductor, and that conductor is the person who's running everything.
Yeah. So, by the way, you mentioned those Neumann M50s. There's we'll link to this in the show notes, but there's all kind. I'd heard Decca Tree before, didn't know what the heck it looked like or sounded like, but yeah, there's plenty of information on the web, and the Neumann M50s are specifically mentioned in a couple of places. So yeah, we'll put those links in the show notes.
Indeed, and one of the other things which we like to do is when we're using these particular recording techniques like Decca Tree is that they're made to make sure that surround works as well as stereo and fold down to mono. We have a strong grounding with that center microphone to make sure that there is a strong center image in what we're recording. We're not, that's one of those things which I try to emphasize to people. Always make sure that what the techniques that you're using can be adapted and work not only in surround and stereo, but also all the way back down to mono, vice versa. And you'll see a spot microphone there on the stage, by the way, if you look closely. It's basically in the middle of the stage.
Yeah.
It's there for the woodwinds. Remember I mentioned about delaying microphones? We delay that microphone so the time of arrival, those instruments there in that section of the orchestra into the recording is the same time of arrival as it would hit to the Decca Tree. Very important.
Folks, you are watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 266. Our guest, along with Chris Tobin and myself, our guest is Alex Kozorek. And he is a recording engineer and consultant, among other things. High quality audio. He's all about that. And he's in are you in Phoenix? Is that where you're at, Alex?
That's correct. Phoenix, Arizona.
All right. We have more from Alex. God, we've learned so much already. My head's about to explode. But we're going to talk about loudness and the BS-1770, web delivery, just all kinds of more issues about quality and workflow, transcoding. All that's coming up in the second half of our show. This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by the folks at Telos and the Telos HX1 and HX2 telephone hybrids. Now these are classic. Well, the classic in that, you know, this we can trace the DSP action back to Steve Church's original design, but we've made so many more improvements over the last 30 plus years in these codecs. Now, the HX1 and HX2 are still POTS codecs, and there are still plenty of places where POTS codecs are getting put in. I have seen literally hundreds and hundreds of these HX1s and HX2s in radio production environments, at podcaster environments, individual studios. If you've got, you know, it's still the easiest way to connect, and you don't necessarily have to have POTS from the phone company coming into your facility in order to connect a POTS codec. Let's say that you just need a quick and easy codec, hybrid to connect phone calls with. Well, All you need to do is hook this up to, let's say, a POTS port on your PBX system. Let's say you're part of a big business and you've got a big PBX there. Hook it up to a POTS port. It'll work just fine. Let's say that you need some you've got VoIP service coming into your home. Let's say through Vonage, which is a proprietary format. You there's no way you can plug that into an asterisk of a VoIP system, for example. So just get a POTS output out of that, out of your Vonage system, for example, or Magic Jack, or whatever your connection is. Almost all of them still offer a least common denominator connection with POTS, and you're going to get really good quality out of this. Despite whatever connection you've got, you're going to get the best quality that will come out of it. Now, if you have regular POTS lines too, that can be helpful in that the HX1 and HX2 can be set for the individual characteristics of the POTS system in every country on Earth. Something like 140 plus different settings are available to match your line voltage, your pickup current, the ringing cadence, and all lots of other characteristics, impedance included, of the phone line. Plus, there's Omnia audio processing in the HX1 and HX2. Now, the HX1, by the way, is a single line telephone hybrid. The HX2 is a dual line hybrid. The HX2 you can treat as two completely separate hybrids, or you can cross connect them with just a couple of dip switch settings, cross connect them so that they work together in a conferencing mode. So if you want to take calls on the air and you want to use two phone lines, you can use the HX2 to have a caller on the air, let's say an expert guest like Alex Kazorik here on this show, and then you can have listener callers call in, and keeping that the expert guest on the air, have those callers interact. Even if your audio console doesn't have two mix minus feeds, the HX2 will provide that conferencing between them for you. Just amazing, amazing box. A couple other features: the HX1, HX2 can be set to auto answer and auto disconnect, so you can use them for information lines if you want to, or listen lines. I'll tell you what they're really popular for, and they're still being used for this, is an IFB call-in line of TV stations or radio stations that send a reporter out. Quick call into your designated phone number. It'll auto-answer and connect you right in to the intercom system at the TV station. So plenty of uses for these devices, the HX1 and HX2. I got to tell you, the HX2 is one heck of a great value for two hybrids. If you need two, look at the HX2 and look at its pricing from your favorite dealer, and you're going to find that it is just a really, really inexpensive hybrid for all the stuff that it does, and you get two of them in the same box. If you would, check it out on the website at telosalliance.com. Click then on the Telos tab and the telephone hybrids, and you'll see the HX1 and the HX2. In use everywhere. You've probably heard one today and didn't even know it. Alrighty, it's episode 266 of This Week in Radio Tech. I'm Kirk Harnack along with Chris Tobin. Chris, you want to check in from your rooftop location in Manhattan? Oh, there he is. He has to go get his microphone.
Yes, yes. Hang on. The sun is moving, so I have to sort of move out of the way of the direct light.
Yeah, gotcha. Gotcha.
Yeah, so I have a nice water tower behind me. I should get a little spigot and get some water out of it.
I wonder what it'd be like to have a live streaming surround feed, an immersive surround feed from the top of some skyscraper in Manhattan. Wouldn't that be
kind
of interesting?
That's exactly what I was thinking. I was also thinking to myself, There's probably plenty of water there. We don't have a lot of that here in Arizona.
You'd be right behind Chris. Yeah, there's a lot of water right there.
Two large water tanks, yes.
You know what would also be cool is to have some immersive surround arrays in Central Park. Man, I tell you what, I have never lived in New York City, but spending some time there, I got to believe Central Park. Yeah, I know TV shows show Central Park as a place where you go, where you might get killed after midnight. Central Park is where you keep your sanity in a place like New York. It's so relaxing. So many corners of the park, just, oh my goodness, it's like being out in the middle of the country. And I would love to hear a immersive sound array from Central Park live streaming.
Well, the reason Central Park exists is for that reason alone. It was for people to get away, the city folk to get away to the country without leaving the city.
Yeah.
It's all man-made. Everything in Central Park is man-made, including the rocks that you may climb on and the water you pass, the pond and everything. It's all been placed there by human hands.
Yep. Very good design, though. I mean, it's just it feels very natural. A lot of places feel like isn't there a place called the Bramble or the Ramble or something like that?
Yeah,
it feels like you got lost in the woods.
Oh yeah, Prospect Park in Brooklyn is similar. It's actually larger, I believe. It's similar effect.
Alex, we have a number of other subjects to cover. Anything more that you want to wrap up with on this sound acquisition techniques here that you've been talking about for the last half hour?
Well, I think the best thing to mention is, even though we got a lot into the surround sound and immersive content, to go back to basics for just a moment and ensure that everybody knows that to create a really great recording, doesn't matter what genre, it really takes just making sure that your knowledge of keeping it to the basics, to the core. Two sets of microphones makes a stereo recording. You don't need 50 microphones to make a stereo recording. Two, to start off with two, making sure that your gain is set correctly, and recording into the medium with plenty of headroom, especially with digital today. The signal-to-noise ratio of digital and the quality of products has gotten so high at a very economical price. And just do the recording justice by making sure you have all that set up well, keep it basic, and use your ears. If it doesn't sound good, try changing where you put those microphones, and just keep it basic, keep it simple. It doesn't need to be highly complex.
Chris may have some follow-up questions, but I've got two right off the bat. Does the binaural technique, maybe with an added microphone on the top or a microphone array on the top, does that have any application here?
Yes, there is a whole – I don't spend a lot of time in binaural, so I can't talk too much to it, or at least not very intelligently, I would say. But I do know that binaural is a different way of getting immersive recordings. But primarily, the reason why I don't spend a lot of time into it is, even though a lot of us wear earbuds with our Apple iPhone or whatnot, it's not the norm. Not everybody's wearing a pair of headphones trying to get this immersive experience going on. It's more or less, you want to make sure it translates to speakers and to a television, so on and so forth. And oftentimes a binaural recording won't translate well.
Okay.
That's the issue that's there.
So my second follow-up question is, would it just be absolutely goofy to have a technique where you mic every instrument close and mix 72 microphones together? Is that just goofy?
It's done quite a bit.
That's
when
quite,
we watch,
quite often.
Yeah, when we watch, let's say, one of the awards shows, Academy Awards or whatnot,
yeah,
almost every instrument is mic'd up close, and we are mixing it on a large desk or whatnot, and then we're trying to create that same feel. The main difference between those two is, one, with using just a few microphones, what we like to call the minimal microphone technique, is we're allowing the ensemble, the conductor, and the acoustics to create the sound that we want. And if we're in a pit orchestra or we're doing something for live television where you got to mic everything close, then we're artificially creating the environment. One's not better than the other. They're just different.
Gotcha. All right. Chris, I'm sorry. Did you have something to follow up with?
You're talking about instruments, 72 instruments or plus or minus. It's done often. The binaural stuff I've done, I did recordings many years ago. And yes, it's best experience with headphones. And outside of that, it can be difficult to enjoy. But it is an interesting recording technique. It's fun. You do hear things in a time, space, frequency relationship that you probably are not accustomed to. And if you are wearing headphones, and I can tell you one of the recordings I made, which was a live jazz quartet outside at a beach. There was a radio station helium tank that were doing balloons for a giveaway, and it was standing behind me. So if you see my hand and think visually behind me, say about 20 feet, 30 feet, they're blowing up balloons, and you hear that sound. Well, wearing the headphones, listening to the music recording, all of a sudden you hear literally come from behind you the sound of the helium. And I've had people wearing headphones in a room suddenly turn their heads to the right. And I'm like, oh, must be the balloons. That is the time, space, the three-dimensional or the coolness, if you will, about binaural recordings, or if you now with the immersive, you can create that effect where you visually are looking or listening to something, say, in the foreground in front of you, and all of a sudden something comes out to you from a different dimension, I'll call it. and your brain registers something's shifted, literally phasing, you now turn your head. That had to be the coolest thing we did with the recordings. And I was like, oh, wow, now I really understand what some of these folks go crazy with when they do binaural recordings and the, what's it called? Oh, Fritz. The Fritz head, right?
Yeah, the Fritz head, yes.
Yes. I did a lot of reading up on that when I was doing these recordings. And then I tried the same concept with the Fritz head using two condenser mics, Velcroed into it to the collars of my shirt for a Joe Jackson concert at Radio City Music Hall to record it in the same fashion that he has, as Alex was mentioning, acoustically rather than all this crazy, all the microphones. And that too was sort of a, you know, quasi-binaural, if you will. But it was definitely, it was pretty cool. And again, that too, I heard conversations behind me, to the side, in front of me, while listening to Joe Jackson perform. It was pretty cool. So yeah, I would say if you're going to record stuff, don't think that it's set in stone. You have to do it one way or the other. Just as Alex pointed out, you make a recording, stereo is two microphones, or multiple, or 5.1, or multiple, whatever it is. But listen to it, listen to the mix, and try and capture what the event is about or at the moment. If it's music, try to capture what the artists are trying to, you know, convey.
Yeah, I don't mean to diverge on another story here, but I remember when I was listening to one of my first binaural recordings, and it actually had had sirens in it. And this was, oh, geez, 15, 20 years ago. And I was home visiting my family. And here I am in the back seat of my parents' car. Now, I'm about 22, 23 years old and still think I'm a hotshot or something like that. And I'm listening to this thing and going, Mom, pull over. There's a cop coming up. And she's like, what the heck is going on?
Oh, gee. Oh, my goodness. Hey, you know what? We're going to run out of time here in the next 10 or 15 minutes. So let's move along to a couple of things that I would love to hear about. Alex, before the show, we were talking a bit about loudness. And you mentioned the BS-1770 standard. And you may have mentioned another one in our conversation, too. Can you talk to us a bit about loudness and measuring loudness? You know, in the world of most of us broadcast engineers, we're always trying to crank it up, and you know, we're trying to have loudness that people can listen to our station in any environment, and it still sounds pretty good. But we know we got to change the original dynamics of what got recorded. Of course, nowadays with you know, CD mastering being the way it is, or song mastering being the way it is, we don't have to change much. In fact, we have to undo some of what's been done so we can do our magic to it. But talk to us about loudness and how we ought to be thinking about loudness.
Well, when I mention loudness, it's usually before that end broadcast processor where everybody is trying to make the be present on the dial and so on and so forth. What I mainly deal with loudness is how we are actually sending the audio from one location to another and making it more uniform. It's been an issue in various types of broadcasting, radio and television, and a lot of people have been circling around a variation of what's called the BS-1770 standard. And that standard has been revised a few times. I think we're up to BS-1770-3, the third revision. And it basically is a measurement standard that tells us what at least tries to mimic, okay, this is the loudness of how we perceive it in an environment. You know, set the volume on a console and you're hearing something coming at you and it's a certain loudness. We have the scale, they call it LUFS or LU, and I'll get into that in a second. But it's supposedly, it mimics what we think is loudness because the other types of scales that are out there, peak reading meters or whatnot, don't really give you a sense of how loud something is. And that's what this new standard is there to help us with.
Okay.
So the next thing is also been adopted by various organizations around the world. Here in the United States, it's A85. And A85 is used primarily for television broadcasting. Here in the United States, most stations run at a loudness unit below full scale. So I'll get to what that means, what LUFS is. So that's what LUFS stands for, loudness units below full scale. Full-scale digital, meaning 0 dBFS. When you hit 0, they can't go any farther beyond that. So most broadcasters in the television world are broadcasting around minus 24, minus 23 LUFS. And that's sort of what they say, hey, we need to broadcast at that level. And and it allows us a lot of headroom, a lot of dynamics can come back into the content that we're listening to. But it also, because it allows for that dynamics to occur, and I'm probably not saying this most effectively, it allows us, when it does get to something like onto a radio station, where the audio does need to be compressed to be on the dial at a certain level, it allows us to control that audio much more effectively with much less artifacts, much less distortion, so on and so forth. Because if you're broadcasting at a louder, or you're sending material that's a lot louder before it even gets there, have you heard the term hypercompression?
Sure, yeah.
Certainly. Yeah. So when things become hyper-compressed, you can't really squeeze much more out of them. That's why there are these various techniques now to undo a level of squash that's there. Here in our production studio alone, we have three different types of declippers and different things to try to get the dynamics back into the music. So I encourage people to listen or to look up these standards called BS-1770. You can Google it. You can put it into YouTube. There's lots of videos that can express this and teach you much more effectively than I'm probably talking about it now. And share that, hey, if you are using a loudness scale and you're going at a relatively conservative loudness level, minus 23, minus 24, which is pretty much the norm here in the United States of how we're trying to send material or should be sending material from one another. It is the PBS standard. It is the standard for PRSS, which is one of the distribution methods for public radio. And other entities, they're using the BS-17 standard, where minus 23 or minus 24 lufs is the loudness level that we're trying to get to. And that allows for, boy, up to 20 dB or more of dynamic range. It's just wonderful.
Gotcha. All right. We'll provide links to various documents in the show notes if folks want to have a look at that. We're gonna unfortunately run out of time here. I'm going to talk about our final sponsor here. And when we come back, Alex, if you would, and Chris, add your thoughts to this as well. Think about what you've talked about and so far in terms of audio quality and capture, and then give us some comments on what the broadcast engineer ought to be thinking about to maintain quality as best we can. Is there anything that we're doing that we shouldn't be doing or not doing that we ought to be doing? And we might be addressing the engineers more at fine arts radio stations where dynamic range and plenty of it is more allowable. But maybe we can also speak a bit to engineers at commercial stations where dynamic range is generally not what we're at really after all the time. But I'd like to hear about maintaining audio quality through and maybe where we're going in the future with regard to high sample rates and lots of bit rates. And please, let's get rid of audio compression where we can, because hard drive space is so cheap nowadays. You're watching or listening to This Week in Radio Tech, episode 266, with Alex Kazorik as our guest and Chris Tobin as along as our co-host, broadcasting from Manhattan. And one of our sponsors for the show is Lavo and the Lavo Crystal Clear Audio over IP Audio Console. This console is really interesting in that, okay, it's traditional in the fact that there's this rack mount box, and this is where all your audio inputs and outputs go. This is where your mics can plug into, analog ins and outs, AES, digital ins and outs, and there's also networking capability where you can get the Ravenna standard, which also is AES 67 compatible. So, you've got all your inputs and outputs on this one rack unit box. You can also get dual redundant power supplies in that as well. So that's the mixer. That's where it goes on. But that's not the part that you touch. That's not the part that the disc jockey or announcer or program producer touches. That part that you manipulate is now on a touch screen, a multi-touch touch screen that's actually a Windows PC with this app that just takes over the whole screen and looks like an audio console. Now, the audio console on screen is nice and large. You can easily get to all the faders and the buttons, no problem. You can move several faders up and down touch buttons at the same time because it's a 10-touch touch screen, and that's all I could handle with 10 fingers. But it's an app that runs, and it's networked over to the DSP mixing engine. So this this networked console can be anywhere on the network. If you need to pick up and move to a different studio, no problem. If you need to pick up and move to, I don't know, your desk, no problem. You can do a show from your desk. And what's interesting is that since the console is literally designed in software, there's nothing on the screen that isn't designed on purpose in software. All the buttons are context sensitive. They're contextual. So if you hit an options button on a mic channel, you get options just for mics, just for what you want to do right there. It's very interesting concept, and I think it's going to be important for a lot of broadcasters to look at going with this technique, because you have so much flexibility. And I think it's just the beginning of this kind of technique. Check it out on the web. There's a video where Mike Dosh, the director of virtual radio projects at Lavo, demonstrates this product, the Lavo Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Mixing Console, talks about how to use it, how it works, and why it's designed the way it is. If you go to Lavo, L-A-W-O, that's the German word, Lavo, L-A-W-O.com, and look for radio consoles, and then look for the Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Mixing Console. You'll see the page you see on the screen right now in the upper right-hand corner. There's Mike Dosh, a little thumbnail from the video where he's explaining how this works. And check it out. Contact your nearest dealer and see if you can take one for a spin. All right. Appreciate Lavo for sponsoring this portion of This Week in Radio Tech and the Lavo Crystal Clear Virtual Radio Console. All right, we're back for our final few minutes. Alex, I was asking you to think about your messaging to broadcast engineers about audio quality. Got some advice for us?
Well, yeah, certainly. I think that a lot of things have changed now that we're into the digital domain.
Oh, yeah.
And a lot of things become much more simplistic. And you mentioned audio over IP, which is another way of getting audio information. And everything now seems to ensure that we're connecting everything at least at 16-bit, usually at 24-bit linear audio. And I think one of the important things is to always double check, I'd say dot your I's, cross your T's, and making sure that everything is actually communicating appropriately. I've been in a lot of different situations where you have a 24-bit I/O device, but inside the device you've accidentally turned on dither to dither down to 16-bit when you don't need to do so. Everything else is communicating at 24 bits. Those types of simple checks in your system to ensure that everything is communicating at the best bit rate and hopefully in a linear audio fashion really help with audio quality. Whether or not the source is popular music or classical music, it doesn't really matter. If we have everything in a linear storage format as well as being communicated through the entire broadcast chain as linear audio at the best bit rate and hopefully the best sample rate as well, that really gives us effective amount of best amount of quality. And the other thing is headroom. We are so used to saying, okay, I was always thinking for years, I need to get as close to digital zero as possible. Mm-hmm. Now at 24-bit depth and the chips that are available these days in a very economical little boxes, even the ones from M-Audio that cost like, what, $88.
Okay.
The performance of those things are fantastic. We don't need to be hitting digital zero anymore. Leave plenty of headroom in there, especially for your entire broadcast chain. If you have lots of headroom, 6 dB is what I call them, like the minimal. You shouldn't be really getting above minus 6 if you don't have to. And getting that through your entire broadcast chain, use the BS-1770 standard that I mentioned. If you have everything going through your broadcast plant at minus 24 lufs, that will help you maintain headroom almost automatically. And keep that through your entire broadcast plant, because then by the time it gets to the transmitter, it gets to the broadcast processor, regardless of brand, it's going to be the best it can be at that point. And then you can manipulate it and you have much more to work with. And that's really awesome.
Yeah. Good advice. Good advice. Mm-hmm. Chris Tobin from high atop a building in downtown Manhattan. This has been pretty interesting. I've enjoyed this. How about you?
No, I've enjoyed it greatly. Actually, everything Alex has mentioned is spot on. I would say my suggestions pretty much align with Alex's. Is come up with a standard level that you're going to operate with, minus 23, minus 24. Set some type of a standard internally, in with the staff. What I always like to do is educate folks on why and how you're doing it, and then give them the tool. So let's picture a radio station that, say, is jazz music or jazz classical, a combination thereof, and you have several groups that work outside as well as inside the radio station. Well, I'm sure if they're outside, as Alex pointed out in some of his pictures, you know, they had a MacBook and they're using that to record or being part of the laptop-centric recording system. Well, make sure that maybe there's a lux meter on that laptop. So when they're out in the field, they can already look at the proper reference and know where they are. So when that recording makes it back to the studio for any other production work or enhancement or not, or archiving, it's already hopefully at the proper level so that when it goes into production there, they bring it up on their machine and say, oh, yeah, we're good, and we just continue on in the merry way. Same would be true for the consoles. Try and either mark the VU meters, the LED meters, to somewhat represent where they should be for LUFS minus 24, because I'm sure they're not, they're not that kind of a meter, but at least demonstrate throughout the plant, the work chain, the workflow, where to sort of keep an eye on things so that this way, if there's any hiccups, you can catch them real quick. And also, pointing out, as Alex said, with the 24-bit, 16-bit, or anything of that sort, sampling rate, is your plant 44.1, 48, or you're going to 96? And whatever you choose, you're going to have to keep throughout the entire workflow. So when people come in from outside, and maybe you have a Pro Tools facility and you're doing Pro Tools work, are you doing 44.1, 48? Are there work pieces coming in, work parts that are the proper data rates? These are things you want to have up front so that when people are working with you, you sort of have a guidance for them. They know what they're coming in and what they're going to do. That's just a broad strokes. There's a lot of other things you can do. And one thing I want to throw in, this is totally after all this talk. Kirk, you mentioned earlier about orchestra and music scores on a movie, and how do you make the piccolo create a sound, creates a sound and then entails it to the score and to the image that you're watching. If you want to get a real good taste, and if you're a sci-fi buff, it's even better. But if not, watch or listen to, I should say, listen to carefully the score on the Doctor Who series. It's produced by the National Orchestra of Wales. Okay, Murray Gold is the composer, and I watched a couple of interviews from the BAFTA Awards that he received some nominations, and he talks about how he was hired to do a movie score, TV score, but doesn't want it to be a TV score. The producers, it's got to be something different. He goes, well, you want this, you want that. He played pieces, they heard strings, they heard percussion, they heard other things. They're like, that's what we want. He goes, I'm going to need an orchestra. You just can't. And they have the National Orchestra of Wales producing the score for Doctor Who. But when you listen to that score and the character creation, the character identity with each different sound, I'm telling you, once immersive technology gets really easy to implement and things of that nature, it's going to be crazy. But if you want to get a feel for it, how the music, the score, just brings out everything in the visual, that's one of the shows to watch. I just think it's great for that.
And it's actually great that you mentioned that. There is a great documentary that's going to be coming out this fall. It's actually called Score, and it's actually a movie that has all these different composers, probably the one that you just mentioned, and a lot of different orchestras that are involved in this entire process. Because there really is, especially with music, television music, there's a resurgence of this stuff right now.
Well, there's a phrase called the Corn Gold Hollywood music. All right, Corn Gold music of Hollywood. Now it was Wolfgang Corn Gold. And if you know the movie, maybe you remember the movie Robin Hood with Errol Flynn, that music score is his. He was the first composer to use, F major? He went a different approach and brought the orchestra sound and the energy to movie scoring. Okay? This goes back 50 years, 60 years. And that's why I was bringing in the Doctor Who reference, and the movie, the documentary Score is going to probably talk about it in the fall. But if you listen to movies produced in that fashion, and Star Wars in the early days was done that way, there's a difference. John Williams orchestra. So there's something to be said for the visual exciting effect as well as the visual, and you marry them together, you can't go wrong. And I think with immersive audio and the techniques and the ability to take an object and place it in different spots in the sphere of your listening realm, I'm using my hand to go around my head create a sphere for those who are just listening. I just realized what I'm doing. This show is for those visually impaired and audibly not. So, but we're talking audio in more than just a single dimension. So you have to think of it.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah.
Right. You mentioned earlier, what's it going to be like to record something on a rooftop of Manhattan? Well, it's three dimensional. That takes a lot.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
Well, one thing that's become very clear to me through this conversation and where things are going is that audio engineers will have no lack of work, at least high quality work, in the coming years. Audio engineering artists, perhaps. I'm not sure what you call them. People who deal with this gear and work with the sound placement, making sure you have great quality audio to place. And we're up for exciting times ahead, I believe.
And I actually want to plug something really quick, if I don't mind. When it comes to audio engineering and immersive surround, one of the biggest realms right now where there is actually a lack of engineers, a lot of the different broadcasting companies have mentioned this, is in sports. Sports, immersive environment that is around you. If you're in the stadium, you feel it. And creating that in the broadcasting realm is not the easiest thing to do because we're still short these engineers for that. So if there's any of you out there that are thinking of how and what area of broadcasting can I get involved with that can get me dived into immersive surround, I highly encourage looking at going into sports broadcasting.
Sports audio. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sports good. Audio indeed.
Good, 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 good. And remember, there's sports audio all around the world. There's not just football and baseball in the U.S. and basketball. I just got back from Australia, where there's rugby league, which apparently is completely different or somewhat different, and there's Australian rules football, which nobody understands at all. but it's got plenty of opportunities for good audio. Guys, we got to go. Alex, this has been fabulously interesting. I hope that you can find time to come back and visit us another time because we have a lot of things we didn't get to cover.
Be more than happy to.
That's great. Thank you so much. Thank you. Chris Tobin, you are the chief cook and bottle washer at ipcodex.com, something like that. Is that right?
Yes, yes, yes. Just support at ipcodex.com. I'd be more than happy to help you out and make things happen for you. And
all right.
Just for the record, I said earlier, if you do a search in the search engine for the H&M building in Times Square, New York City, that's where I'm at. That's the rooftop.
The H&M building. All right.
Yeah. I'm on the south side, so I'm looking at Empire State Building and One World Trade Center and a few other landmarks facing downtown Manhattan.
Sounds good. Wish I was there. Yeah. All right, guys.
Oh, by the way,
thanks so much.
This is all done LTE, remember. This is all wireless.
And I'm amazed at how well you make that stuff work. Hey, remember, next week we'll look at your Go Kit.
Yes.
Thanks a lot to Suncast for producing this episode of This Week in Radio Tech and to Andrew Zarian, who's out today but provides the network, the GFQ network, with lots of interesting shows that you should check out at gfqnetwork.com. Alex Kazorik has been our guest today along with Chris Tobin, who's our usual co-host. Thanks to our sponsors. Please visit them and tell your friends about This Week in Radio Tech. You can find us at thisweekinradiotech.com. If you'll just subscribe to the podcast, it'll automatically get loaded onto your favorite device or devices. I think I'm responsible for about 4 downloads a week on 4 different devices. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.